This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we talk with attorney Martin Garbus, who stepped into attorney Len Wineglass's shoes in the case of the Cuban Five.
Perhaps millions of our tax dollars went to pay journalists to write prejudicial articles about the Cuban Five before, during, and after their trial.
We'll talk about a recent court victory in the area of greenhouse gas emissions.
Finally, a court said what industry didn't want. The Environmental Protection Agency can regulate what's coming out of your car's exhaust pipe.
We'll talk with attorney Roger Wareham about a recent petition to the International Criminal Court demanding that they prosecute the United States and other countries for war crimes.
Roger is a New York-based international human rights attorney concentrating on exposing the role of the United States in its attempt to recolonize Africa. Roger is carrying on the task of giving international publicity to American racism, a task that Malcolm X left behind for us to follow up on.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Smith.
I'm Heidi Boghossian, Executive Director of the National Lawyers Guild.
And I'm Michael Ratner, President Emeritus of the Center for Constitutional Rights.
Michael, you've been representing Julian Assange here in the United States. There's just been a tremendous amount of news about him, particularly after he gave that speech from the balcony of the Ecuadorian embassy in London. A lot of op-ed articles, a lot of interest now in his predicament. Where is it at?
I wish it had been from the balcony, but if you noticed it closely, he stayed within the doorframe of the Ecuadorian embassy. They weren't sure that the balcony was part of the Ecuadorian embassy, and they were afraid that he could be seized if he actually walked onto the balcony. So if you look at the picture, he's in the frame. But he gave, I thought, a very good talk. I particularly liked it because he emphasized the general attacks on whistleblowers and publishers of secrets, of corruption articles, of criminality by governments, and didn't really talk very much about himself, but about others like Bradley Manning, who are under the government's gun in terms of their government's suppression of secrecy and going after whistleblowers. I thought he looked courageous in doing it. He's a courageous man for what he's been able to do. But you're seeing now a reaction, particularly among a bunch of the major media and others, The Guardian, The New York Times, which is writing some very nasty stuff, both about Correa, the president of Ecuador, and Ecuador, about what should happen to Ecuador because they gave asylum. You, of course, saw the article that the British claimed that they were going to attack and assault the embassy to get Assange out of there. I think the British made a huge mistake in doing that. It backfired. Embassies are sacrosanct. The idea that the British were going to go in there to pull out Julian Assange was pretty remarkable. But, of course, it came out of a context, the context being a big country versus some small little country like Ecuador. And the British thought if they threatened Ecuador like that Ecuador would back down, not give Julian Assange asylum, and that would be the end of it. But of course, Ecuador, I think the British surprise, despite all the possible negative consequences to Ecuador from the British and other trading partners, stood up for Julian Assange, stood up for the independence and sovereignty of Ecuador, and said, we're giving him asylum. Ecuador then brought together a meeting of the Organization of American States, which then voted to have a meeting of the foreign ministers of the OAS. And so it went from an issue of having to do with Julian Assange, WikiLeaks, British Embassy, etc., into now a huge confrontation between the former colonizers and empire, and the empire treating the colonies as if the UK was still the empire. So that backfired tremendously. The other attacks that have been on Julian Assange are people who are trying to minimize the threat of U.S. prosecution. Look, we at the Center for Constitutional Rights look closely at this. We follow the grand jury. We follow the Bradley Manning case. We follow the Twitter subpoenas. And we know very well that there is an ongoing, intense investigation of WikiLeaks and Julian Assange. We know the number of the grand jury, 10-GJ-3793. That's the year 2010, GJ grand jury. 3, the conspiracy statute. 793, the espionage statute. We know they either have indicted Julian Assange already or will do so soon. So there's a clear effort to get Julian Assange here. The Ecuadorians gave him asylum because of the threat of the United States persecuting him for what are protected speech activities. What the attack you're seeing is people saying, well, he went into the embassy because he didn't want to go face up to this allegations in Sweden of sexual misconduct. I just think that's utterly false. Julian Assange will go to Sweden the minute he has a guarantee that he will not be extradited to the United States. If he were to ever get that guarantee from some combination of Sweden, the United Kingdom, and the United States, I have no doubt that he would go to Sweden and answer questions concerning the allegations of sexual misconduct in Sweden. The one other thing I want to say on that, here you see this huge diplomatic brouhaha having been created by what Britain did, and all that is being asked right now of Sweden, and Ecuador offered this to Sweden, come to the United Kingdom, come to London, come to our embassy, do your questioning of Julian Assange in the embassy, and see if you can resolve it there. Has Sweden agreed to do that? No, they have not. And so you have to ask yourself, why is Sweden refusing to do what is very simple to do? Get the prosecutor on a plane and go question Julian Assange. The only excuse can be is because they want to get their hands on him in Sweden, because he'll be in jail in Sweden immediately. There's no bail. And he will then, in a more rapid process, be extradited to the United States. So it's a lot of chicanery going on here. The demand should be for Sweden to do what it should have done a long time and go question Julian Assange in the United Kingdom. There are no criminal charges against Julian Assange. There's allegations. Perhaps the questioning, in fact, I think the questioning of Julian Assange would probably put those to rest. But until that happens, of course, we have this standoff. We could also insist, and we should, that the United States back off on any effort to investigate and prosecute WikiLeaks. But of course, you know, in this country, they've asked to string him up. I mean, remember the words of our vice president, Julian Assange is equivalent of a high-tech terrorist. That's how they think of Julian Assange. And as I close this little update, let's remember the good that WikiLeaks has done, the revelations it's made around the world. The Tunisians gave it credit, WikiLeaks, for at least one strand of their revolution. We've seen what's happened with the collateral murder video, the killing of the Reuters journalists, the exposure of thousands of more deaths in Iraq and Afghanistan than the U.S. was ever willing to admit. You just didn't dig into that pile of WikiLeaks documents and the hypocrisy and criminality of the United States and other great powers, as well as other governments, is seen clearly. That's what this prosecution of Julian Assange and WikiLeaks is about. It's our obligation to defend whistleblowers like Bradley Manning, publishers and journalists like Julian Assange and WikiLeaks.
You can go to the Center for Constitutional Rights website and get updates from the CCR.
CCRjustice.com. CCRjustice.org. You can also follow me and my tweets on Julian Assange. It's at Just Left. At Just Left. We do a lot of tweeting between myself and the center on WikiLeaks and Julian Assange.
Earlier this summer, we talked with renowned First Amendment and Civil Rights attorney Martin Garvis about joining the Cuban Five legal defense team, really stepping in after Len Wineglass passed away a year and a half ago. The Cuban Five, our listeners will remember, are five Cubans, now four because one is out of prison, who were imprisoned because they were attempting to defend the island against terrorist attacks launched from Florida against Cuba. The United States accused them of terrorism, framed them up, put them in prison. Attorney Garbus recently filed an affidavit in the Miami Federal District Court based on U.S. government misconduct in paying Miami journalists to write hysterical articles about the Cuban Five before and during the trial. The affidavit supports Cuban Five defendant Gerardo Hernandez's habeas corpus appeal and seeks to overturn his wrongful conviction. Attorney Martin Garvis, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you.
It's very nice to have you, and we so applaud your picking up the work from Len Wineglass and carrying on this defense of the Cuban Five. Now we found out that the government was paying journalists to write negative articles about the Cuban Five. Why isn't this jury tampering?
Well, I think it is jury tampering. We're saying that every dollar that was paid and there were a lot of dollars paid as well, you know, many millions of dollars, as a violation of the integrity of the jury trial. We're saying that every person who was involved in the payments, whether it be the person who made the payments, the government, the Radio Marti, or the person who received the payments, the journalists, also violated the law and violated the integrity of the jury trial. We're saying that the jury trial was destroyed by a propaganda machine, a foreign propaganda machine, that was then turned inward onto the people of Miami. So we feel quite secure in the idea that the jury was tampered with. The government then says, well, you have to prove that. We have to prove it. We have to go back and meet those 12 jurors and say this, that, or the other thing. We say quite to the contrary. When there's a violation of law this way, and the government has violated the law, then jury tampering should be like a per se, if you will.
Like the fruits of an illegal search.
Yes.
Let me see if I understand this, Marty. There were a number of journalists covering the Cuba 5 trial a few years ago, and they were paid by the American government to do what you would call articles propaganda outside the United States, Radio Marti, etc. No, I'm getting it wrong.
No, that's all right. There are several different allegations. One, yes, there's Radio Marti. In 1996, just at about the time of the shootdown, Radio Marti moves from Washington to Miami. It's the only Voice of America station, if you will, that doesn't operate out of Washington. And the history of that and the research we have done shows it was because basically the government was prepared to give the Cuban exiles control of Radio Marti, so that the radio station goes there, a great number of Cuban exiles are hired. Now, what kinds of people are hired? Many of them have Bay of Pigs history. Many of them were imprisoned in Cuba. So that's one source of information which then comes into Miami. It's Radio and TV Marti, the government station itself. Neither Radio Marti nor TV Marti have any particular intrusion into Cuba. TV Marti doesn't get there at all, and Radio Marti is easily jammed. So in 1996, there's a recognition that Radio Marti no longer has an overseas function, a function aimed at Havana or Cuba directly. And there's a recognition that it's totally internal to affect the Cuban exile population in Miami. So one thing that they do is they take Radio Marti and they do exactly what we're talking about. Two, they then go to newspapers, the Miami Herald and the Nuevo Herald, who have nothing to do with Radio Marti, and they start to give those journalists money.
Who's they? Who's passing out the money?
Radio Marti.
Okay.
The money.
Where does Radio Marti get its money?
From the government. It's government money.
Our government. Okay.
So, now, what we have been able to locate, and we have filed an 80-page affidavit with hundreds and hundreds of pages of exhibits. We have gone relentlessly through payments made by Radio Marti, made by the government, to journalists. And we have come up with a number of journalists, thus far, let's say 11, who have received close to $1 million for their work. They worked on the independent news media, the Miami Herald, the Nuevo Herald. They worked in CBS. They worked on TV stations. And they did shows on radio and TV, not Radio Marti, but regular talk shows. And they received government monies for their work doing that. And the articles that they wrote have to be read, should be read fairly carefully. Beside, again, fighting the Cold War in the Florida Straits, what you have is an argument that the people who are being tried in the case were the early landing force for a Cuban invasion of Miami, that namely that Castro, his power was ending, and the way he was going to resurrect that power was he was then going to land in Miami, and that these people, the defendants, were laying the groundwork for it.
You mean to say they actually put forth the theory that there was going to be a landing from Cuba and that the Cuban Five were actually there to begin to...
Reverse Bay of Pigs, that the Cubans are going to try to capture Miami?
Exactly.
I love that.
That's really crazy. And our tax money is paying for this? Mm-hmm. And you're saying that this polluted the jury pool?
Right. And what you're also saying is this. You take a particular article by a particular guy. And this particular article lauds as heroes people like Orlando Bosch or other people that America has jailed or America has prosecuted and put in jail because of violent acts against citizens, Cuban and otherwise. So you have a whole group of people who have been imprisoned by the American government. these writers talk about these people as if they're heroes. Secondly, these writers criticize the American government for having prosecuted these guys, so that American money is being given to writers who are then attacking America, which has prosecuted people who have killed Americans. So it is convoluted beyond, it is incomprehensible with respect to the amount of money spent. It's totally unprecedented. You have a media campaign which goes from 1996, February 1996, the shootdown. The conviction is in 201. It's 5 years. It's about 2,000 days. The trial itself is 194 days. And what you have is a steady barrage. Now, with respect to the information that we've come up, the information we've come up is only, I think, a tip of the iceberg. We don't know how much other money these people got for doing other things. For example, in Cuba, in Miami, there are many democratic-sounding entities that were conduits for Cuban exile funds, National Endowment for Democracy, and others. So you see money coming from those entities as well into these people. We know about the money going. We know about the money coming. We don't have a total picture yet of all the money flowing in, and we don't have a picture of the specific conversations between Radio Marti and the journalists who were hired. Now, one of the things the journalists did when it was exposed, when the beginning of it was exposed in the Miami Herald, September 8, 2006, the Miami Herald publishes a front-page story, banner headlines, our staff is being paid by the government. These people are then fired. And the headline also talks about people at CBS, at El Nuevo Herald, and other places. Now, the Miami Herald did a six-month investigation. They couldn't get enough of the information. New York Times gets involved. This is back in 2006. The Associated Press, the Chicago Tribune. Everybody knows that they have touched something, but nobody knows how deeply it goes, and nobody relates it back to the trial. Some of our information is during the period 1996-2001. Some of it is after, and some of it is before. We have, for example, a curricula vitae by various journalists who say, yes, we got this through FOIA. I was working for the government. I was working for the non-government stations. And they talk about how when they would write an article for the Nuevo Herald, they would then use that article both on Radio Marti, which is supposed to be going overseas, which of course is not, and the non-governmental radio. I don't know if I've made it sufficiently clear, because it is complex and it does intertwine.
Well, you've made it clear, Marty, real clear, that something stinks in Miami. Mm-hmm. There was a government attempt, our tax money, to pervert a jury pool. What are you trying to do here? And then I want to ask you how people can learn more about it and get involved.
We're trying to vacate the conviction. We're claiming that the conviction was as a result of the words that you use, which is jury tampering. The judge tried to maintain some control over the publicity and caution the jury, but she had no idea of the extraordinary amount of money coming in and where it was coming from. And the people who had every right to believe that they were hearing independent voices were in fact hearing misrepresented paid journalists. And all of them, most of these articles, have the same theme. It looks like one person wrote it. It looks like they appear to be monolithic. The same beginning, middles, and ending, the same heroes and villains, and the same struggle of the free world against this dictatorship 90 miles away.
You know, Marty, it reminds me of a story we used to hear in the old days before the Soviet Union went under, that it was government-paid propaganda in their state-sponsored newspapers. So, you know, people thought, rightly, that a lot of stuff were lies. But here, you know, you think it's a free democratic press, and it's lies. So it's even more insidious.
Exactly correct. You really put your finger on it.
Anyway, tell us how we can get in touch with you and the organization that's supporting the Cuban Five and follow this.
The National Mobilization to Free the Five. It's freethefive.org. And that's the site that has all the information about this. It has all the previous history of the case. It has the decisions. It has some of Lenny Wineglass's marvelous, wonderful briefs and some interviews that Lenny gave. And I think Lenny's interviews are wonderful because they put the case in perspective.
Beautiful. Marty Garbus, always a pleasure to talk to you. We're going to follow up on this. We're following the story. And Michael and I and Heidi, thank you very
much
for being on
Law
and Disorder.
Thank you.
Thank you, Marty.
Bye-bye.
April 2007, the U.S. Supreme Court handed down its first decision related to climate change issues. The case was Massachusetts versus EPA. The court held that the Clean Air Act authorized the Environmental Protection Agency to regulate greenhouse gases. That is then what the EPA did. It regulated greenhouse gases. But then the industry made another challenge, saying that it was unreasonable to regulate them, that they didn't regulate them right, etc. In a really important victory for our climate, the appeals court in Washington, D.C. upheld the EPA rules. It upheld the endangerment finding of the EPA, which said that greenhouse gases could reasonably be anticipated to endanger public health and welfare. It upheld the tailpipe rule, which set emission standards for cars and trucks, and it upheld the timing and tailoring rule, in which the EPA determined that the Clean Air Act required major stationary sources, such as power plants, to obtain construction and operating permits regarding greenhouse gases. So in a major victory, we may now see our air getting a little cleaner. Today we are joined by law professor Eleanor Stein, who teaches a course called The Law of Climate Change at Albany Law School and SUNY Albany. Welcome, Eleanor, to Law and Disorder.
Thank you very much. It's good to be here.
Eleanor, before we get into the two cases we're going to discuss, can you give us a brief explanation of what greenhouse gases are?
Sure. And let me refer you to the current issue of Rolling Stone, which has a fantastic article by the author Bill McKibben on the new math of greenhouse gas and warming, and it's a very good primer on what greenhouse gases are, how they work, and what the problems are. But in a word, greenhouse gases are chemical substances. There's usually referred to a basket of six substances which contribute to the warming of the Earth because as they accumulate in the atmosphere, they prevent the refraction of the sun's energy away from the Earth and back into space. So it's like what happens in a greenhouse, or think of it as a blanket being placed around the Earth. And of these six substances, the one most often discussed is carbon dioxide, which is the most plentiful in the atmosphere. But it's the among the others, for example, methane, is some of them are much more potent greenhouse gas elements than CO2.
Some of them stay around for years, don't they?
They do, and the other reason why carbon dioxide is the one we discuss most often is that carbon dioxide, once it's emitted into the atmosphere, can remain there for anywhere from 100 to 1,000 years.
We're going to be discussing two cases. The first, which sets the backdrop, is the 2007 U.S. Supreme Court case, Massachusetts v. EPA. What did that hold?
Well, that case held that the Environmental Protection Agency, the EPA, had an obligation to regulate greenhouse gases as an air pollutant if it found that those gases constituted a danger to human health and welfare, and included in that definition is a danger to weather and climate.
And that was an interesting case because it was actually brought and or supported by several states.
Yeah, actually, like the most recent case decided just a month ago, that case had about a dozen states on each side. But remember, that case was brought in, I think, 2003 or 2000. Yeah, it was brought in 2003. And it was a challenge to the George Bush era EPA. And that EPA had denied petitions requesting it to regulate greenhouse gases as air pollutants on the grounds that they, as a matter of policy, would be inadvisable to do so. And on the ground that the EPA argued it didn't have the authority to do it under the Clean Air Act. So it was brought by Massachusetts, New York, and other states which had a relatively progressive record on regulating greenhouse gas.
Oh, I understand it now, because when I thought Massachusetts, I said, what's Massachusetts doing suing the EPA? But now you got
right.
It. It's because
it was the Bush EPA.
Okay.
And the outcome of that case was that the court authorized the EPA to regulate gas emissions if the agency found they posed a danger to human health and welfare.
Yes, and it not only authorized them, it held that the EPA had a statutory obligation to regulate greenhouse gases if they met that, what's called the endangerment test.
What is the most recent court case about?
The most recent court case, it's called the Coalition for responsible regulation against EPA. It was decided in the D.C. Circuit a month ago. And to just go back a step, the Massachusetts case at the Supreme Court was about specifically the regulation of emissions from new motor vehicles. So once the court ordered the EPA to do its endangerment investigation, it did so, and it made an endangerment finding in December 2009, and it found that greenhouse gas emissions were, in fact, a danger to human health and welfare, in a very massive decision based on many volumes of scientific appendix, consulting all the contemporary sciences. So that was its first decision after Massachusetts, the endangerment finding. Once it found that greenhouse gases posed danger, the EPA was required by law to regulate this emissions from new motor vehicles. And they did that by adopting a set of rules known as the tailpipe rules, which went into effect in January of 2011.
And that sets emission standards for cars and light trucks, correct?
That's exactly right.
Just for new cars, Eleanor?
New cars. Now, by operation of law under the Clean Air Act, once substance has been deemed an air pollutant for the purpose of regulating motor vehicles, it automatically becomes subject to regulation from what are called stationary sources, that is, power plants and factories and any other sources that emit large quantities of greenhouse gases.
Let me see if I understand that. Once something becomes an endangered, what'd you call it?
Once it's considered an air pollutant and regulations, the EPA issues regulations for motor vehicles, by operation of law, the EPA is then required to set rules for what are known as stationary sources.
Give me an example of a stationary source.
A power plant. Things that aren't on wheels.
Things that burn coal?
Things that emit greenhouse gases because they burn fossil fuels, generally.
Okay, so it's fossil fuels. It would include natural gas?
Absolutely.
Got it. Okay.
So once the EPA adopted the tailpipe rules for motor vehicles, it then went on to adopt rules for stationary sources. Those rules are known as the timing and tailoring rules, and I can explain to you why that is. So we have the endangerment finding was the first rule. The tailpipe rule was the second on motor vehicles. The third were these timing and tailoring rules. And these three groups of rules are the subject of this current lawsuit.
And the timing and tailoring rule, doesn't that require stationary sources to get construction and operating permits?
That's exactly right. Under the Prevention of Serious Deterioration rules of the Clean Air Act.
So these three rules were challenged in the recent court case.
Say the name of the group again.
The Coalition for Responsible Regulation?
And you may well ask.
Well, Eleanor, these are typical of the kind of groups we get in each kind of area that people are in. You know,
exactly.
The Coalition for like a Reasonable Foreign Policy or whatever they call themselves.
Right. You know? They're also reasonable and responsible.
Right.
And it's interesting. It's a group that does not disclose its membership. It doesn't have a website. But a recent article in The Guardian UK linked it to Solvay, a leading European chemical company. And the case also involves the Chamber of Commerce, Peabody Energy, the U.S. largest coal mining company, and many other participants in the fossil fuel industry, as well as about a dozen states that are primarily coal or oil.
Can you let us know, was the entire industry against these EPA rules? Was it united?
You know, that's a really interesting question, and actually not at all. First of all, the automobile industry essentially made its peace with the tailpipe rules, you know, as they were being adopted. And the fact that part of the automobile industry was a wholly owned subsidiary of the federal government didn't hurt. But they certainly see the handwriting on the wall and are making some adjustments, partly because that's what their customers want. And obviously they know that some form of carbon regulation is coming.
And I guess we skipped a step. The outcome of the recent court decision was that a three-judge court actually upheld those three rules.
They did, and Mike Girard, who heads the Climate Law Center at Columbia Law School, calls this decision a slam dunk for the EPA, and it's actually a tremendous affirmation of current climate science. It's a rejection of a lot of climate denial and other industry myths that are make it so difficult for the government to take action on climate change right now.
And Eleanor, precisely what kind of view of climate change did the court express?
The most extensive discussion in the decision is their analysis of the endangerment finding, which is really the EPA's analysis of the climate science. And essentially, the court held that the EPA's interpretation was reasonable, that they should defer to it because it was consistent with the law, and in the face of a whole range of attacks on the reliability of the climate studies, on attacks on two or three erroneous statements and reports out of literally hundreds of thousands of pages of reports, and a whole range of other attacks, the court, you know, certainly upheld the decision of the EPA as eminently reasonable.
Environmentalists must be thrilled with this decision.
It was a huge victory.
Were these rules actually in effect before the appeal, or were they stayed pending appeal, and now what's going to happen?
I do not believe that the rules were stayed. They are in effect. The tailpipe rules went into effect on January 1st, 2011. The tailoring rule, I believe, is also in effect. The tailoring rule is a phased-in regulation, and what the tailoring is that the EPA, usually it's required under the law to regulate sources of air pollutants that are at either 100 tons or 250 tons per year. That's the cutoff. Anything over that gets regulated by the EPA. But carbon dioxide is emitted at such a larger quantity than, say, lead or sulfur dioxide or soot, that those rules would mean literally hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of sources would be covered. So the EPA set a much higher floor for regulating CO2 emissions. Their floors were 100,000 tons per year as opposed to 100 tons per year for certain sources, which makes a lot more sense in terms of just the nature of CO2. So that's the tailoring rule, and that was upheld, and that's now in effect.
Well, Eleanor, thank you for doing this with us. We really appreciate it, and we'll have you on again soon about this, I hope.
Hopefully with equally good news. Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. This past June, the Pan-African Solidarity Hague Committee delivered a petition to the International Criminal Court in the Netherlands, demanding that they prosecute the U.S., Great Britain, France, Italy, Canada, and NATO for war crimes and crimes against humanity in Libya, the Ivory Coast, Haiti, and the U.S. This campaign began in May last year when thousands gathered to protest the U.S.-NATO bombing of Libya, attacks on Zimbabwe, and the racist assault against African Americans in the United States. The evidence presented laid out a case of crimes committed and was the basis of the petition served this year. To tell us more about the petition, we're joined in the studio by attorney Roger Wareham. He's a member of the December 12th Movement, an organization of African people which organizes in the Black and Latino communities around human rights violations, particularly police terror. Roger is also the International Secretary General of the International Association Against Torture, a non-governmental organization that has consultative status before the UN. Welcome, Roger, to Law and Disorder.
Thank you. I'm very honored to be back.
Well, it's always a pleasure to have you. We're going to talk about your recent petition from the Pan-African Solidarity Hague Committee to the International Criminal Court. And I wanted to first start by asking you to explain, what exactly is the International Criminal Court?
That's a very good question. What it is and what it purports to be are two different things. The International Criminal Court began working 10 years ago this July after 5 or 6 years of preparation. It came out of some of the international tribunals that had been set up around Rwanda, Yugoslavia, and the idea was that there needs to be a permanent institution that can bring war criminals and violators of human rights to task, that nobody is supposed to be immune if they've committed war crimes or crimes against humanity. And so the International Criminal Court was set up in order to do that. The United States was very involved in the whole process of setting up the International Criminal Court and made sure, used its influence to make sure that it had all the sort of protections that the United States wanted to cover itself.
Who sits on this court?
The judges are picked by the members of the countries who have signed on to it. There are approximately, I think, around 116 countries that have signed on at this point, which means that there are about a third of the countries in the world who have not signed on. And so the judges are picked. There's a procedure they have to select judges based on geographical distribution. They don't have to have had a lot of training in the law. Some of them are, in essence, political appointees. And so when the court was set up, after all of the finagling that the U.S. had involved to make sure that it had all the so-called protections that the United States law ensures, the United States signed the treaty, but it never ratified it. So it's really not a member of it. It was signed under Clinton. When Bush came in office, he not only did they make sure not to ratify it, they unsigned, they withdrew their signature from it. But they have a tremendous amount of influence on the court.
What kind of track record does the court have? Have they ruled on cases of import?
After 10 years, the court came forward with its first conviction about 3 months ago. It was a citizen of the Democratic Republic of Congo who was convicted of, I think, crimes against humanity. Its record, in essence, has really been a court to prosecute Africans. Of the cases that are in front of it now, all of them are Africans. It's as if people who are alleged to have violated human rights don't exist outside the African continent. As one observer has said, this is really an African criminal court and not an international criminal court.
That's well put, Roger. So you were part of the Pan-African Solidarity Hague Committee delegation, and you went over there and presented them with this petition. What were you trying to accomplish with this?
One of the things that you can do with the International Criminal Court that you can't do with the International Court of Justice, which requires that one country bring another before it. With the International Criminal Court, non-governmental organizations can bring charges. And as you know from Mike with the CCR, they've brought charges against them with the Vatican around the sexual abuse. So our organization, the December 12th Movement International Secretariat, and also the International Association Against Torture that I'm the International Secretary General of, are NGOs and consultative states with the United Nations. And so the mandate for the International Criminal Court allows these kind of organizations to provide what they call a communication to say that we think that there's enough evidence for you to begin an investigation and to prosecute whoever the people are we're talking about. And so what we did, this was really part of a campaign that began last year during the bombing of Libya, when it was very clear that the United Nations Security Council resolution, which had spoken of creating a no-fly zone, was really being used as a cover to affect regime change. And at that point in time, when we first talked about it in May, it was clear that they were trying to assassinate Colonel Gaddafi. And so we began a campaign to expose what was happening with that. International Criminal Court had taken out a warrant for Colonel Gaddafi, saying he was a human rights violator, committed crimes against humanity and war crimes, which was clearly a political indictment. And so our position was, first was to try and stop the bombing. In May of 2011, when it was clear that they were trying to effect regime change and to assassinate Colonel Gaddafi. We began a campaign to expose that. We called for a Millions March rally in Harlem in August 13th of 2011, and the goal of that was to expose what was happening in Libya, what had happened in Haiti, because we saw that the same pattern in terms of the overthrow of President Aristide in 2004, which had never been addressed by any international institutions. We talked about Zimbabwe in terms it was clear that they were on the radar for the International Criminal Court and the West to come at, because the Western countries were completely opposed to and determined to effect regime change because of the policy of the return of the land to indigenous Zimbabweans that has been enacted by Zimbabwe. And, of course, the situation of people of African descent, of black people in the United States. So at that rally in August 13th, 2011, we raised those issues. Prior to that, we had a forum on violations of international law and crimes against humanity.
Columbia Law.
No, before that, we had one at the Harlem State Office building where Lennox Hines, Jeannie Meyer of the Guild and of the International Association of Democratic Lawyers, King Downing, who at that point was with the American Friends Service Committee, and I raised up the whole issue of international law and what it means to people in the streets of New York. After the August rally, we had the International People's Tribunal at Columbia Law School in January of this year, January 14th, where we had a panel of three judges, Rosemary Mealy, Lennox Hines, and David Kamachong, who came from Barbados, and our prosecutors, who were Antonia Codling, Troy Griffith, Sylvester Quaggio, Alfred Toussaint, and myself, presented evidence in terms of what was happening in Libya, Cote d'Ivoire, the Ivory Coast, which involved the capture and arrest of the President Laurent Gbagbo, who, through French intervention, ended up in the Hague, Haiti, of course, which is forever, and the United States. And from that, the judges found that a prima facie, which means simply a basic case, had been presented to show that there was enough evidence for there to be a petition presented to the International Criminal Court to investigate our allegations of war crimes and crimes against humanity.
So the petition has been presented. What is the time frame for consideration usually?
Right. We took the Pan-African Solidarity Hague Committee, which was the grouping that came together around this, took a delegation of 27 people to The Hague on June 18th. And we personally hand-delivered the communication to the International Criminal Court. We had asked to meet with the chief prosecutor, who is a woman named Fatou Bensouda from the Gambia. She had just been installed in the office that previous Friday. We were there on the Monday, her first working day.
And what a way to start.
Right. And she declined to meet with us for some reason. And so the two of us, David Kamachong and I, went there. We presented the evidence. We presented our petition. They gave us a receipt to acknowledge that. The time frame, I think the history of the ICC is that with issues they don't want to deal with, which is clearly they don't want to deal with prosecuting anybody from the West. Robin Cook, who used to be the foreign minister of Great Britain, said that when the International Criminal Court was first put in place, he said, "I'll be very clear, this is not a criminal court to bring to book prime ministers of Great Britain or presidents of the United States." So it was very clear from the beginning that this wasn't going to be an even-handed, there wasn't going to be a single standard of justice. There was a group that brought a petition to the ICC around the when Israel bombed Gaza and killed all those people.
It was right before Obama took office.
Right.
At the end of 2007, beginning of 2008, killed about 1,348
right.
people, including 260 children.
There was a group that brought a communication around that, and it was only maybe 2 years later, the ICC declined, they declined to accept their petition, saying, I think their technicality was that Gaza wasn't a state or something ridiculous in terms of, but in the answer to your question, I don't know how long it's going to take, because they want to stretch it out and hope that any motion around that will dissipate.
Roger Wareham, I'm holding the petition in my hand. I printed it out. It's on the internet. Before I ask you about some of the highlights of the petition, tell our listeners how they can get it, because they can get it just
certainly.
Like I did.
Oh, certainly. There's a website, a blog spot that people can go to and download it. It is as in Peter, A as in Apple, S as in Sam, H as in Harry, C as in Cat, 2012. In other words, P-A-S-H-C, 2012.blogspot.com. That's P-A-S-H-C, 2012, period, blogspot, period, com.
All right, we're going to have to link to that one on our website.
Okay. That's a lot to remember, right?
We'll link to it.
They'll be able to download the petition and some other documents. There have been some very good articles in a magazine called The New African, which has done a tremendous analysis on the ICC and the bias of the ICC and how it's really a court that's geared for Africans at the behest and for the interests of the Western countries. Our campaign and our position has been that there is a campaign by the West to recolonize the African continent for its resources, in particular, to remove those heads of state that are obstacles in terms of Western repenetration, and that the ICC has now become a very willing tool and weapon in that. And so the idea of the campaign is that we've got that by bringing this petition, that bringing this communication to that, which is substantiated by facts, by irrefutable facts of war crimes and crimes against humanity that were committed during in these different instances in the different countries, that if they ignore that and if they say we're not going to deal with it, and realistically we know that they're not, at least it will help educate people to the fact that this is not a neutral institution, that it is a political institution that is working in certain interests.
Just as political, I would say, as the establishment of the African command that the American military put up to intervene in Africa.
Exactly.
Same politics behind it. But let's talk about the guts of this report. If you had to remind our listeners of some of the highlights of what you put in here, what would you say?
I'd say that I'm sure many people remember the NATO bombing of Libya, and many civilians were killed in those bombings. That even NATO, you know, belatedly acknowledged there were some mistakes. I met recently with a man from Libya who had lost his pregnant wife, his 4-year-old daughter, his 3-year-old son, his 6-year-old niece, and other people who worked in his household. All in all, 13 people were killed. NATO belatedly, like months later, under pressure, admitted that they had made a mistake. Our view was that it wasn't a mistake because he also happened to be the son of one of the generals who assumed power with Gaddafi back in 1964 or 5, whenever it was they took power. And it was really a terrorist attack to show people, because this was in June of last year, that anyone who was associated with Colonel Gaddafi was going to be under fire and encourage people to defect. So we had that, and we had in terms of Libya, we had the issue of the genocidal attack on black Libyans. If you remember, the propaganda was that anybody who was black in Libya was not a Libyan, was from sub-Saharan Africa, and was therefore a mercenary fighting for Colonel Gaddafi, which ignored the reality that that half or more of the population are black, and that to categorize them as that was part of the Western propaganda to demonize it. And so there was a town in particular called Tawaga in Libya where the so-called rebels came in and made all of the inhabitants, it was an entirely black town, made all of the inhabitants leave and disperse throughout the country. They destroyed the town. And to this day, those people are in refugee camps, and they're still being subjected to attack from that. And we accuse NATO of being complicit in that because it was, of all institutions, the Wall Street Journal in June of last year had the first article talking about the destruction of this black town and that they were being attacked because they were black. So it wasn't as if it wasn't known, but the NATO continued to support those rebels who were carrying out those attacks. So, and then, of course, it was a question of the assassination of Colonel Gaddafi, that it was the intelligence that was supplied by NATO and the bombs that forced him to leave the caravan he was in. And when he was finally caught, there's different stories. There's some stories that say that it was some of the NATO troops who were on the ground who captured him and then turned him over to the rebels. And everybody knows from the video he was alive, and then shortly thereafter he was tortured and murdered.
Roger, I have a procedural question. In bringing forth a complaint before the International Criminal Court, Do you have to lay out violations of international human law? Does it vary by country? What are the standards you have to present?
The mandate of the document for the International Criminal Court sets out the question of war crimes. It's war crimes and crimes against humanity, and then there's genocide. And that's one of the things we charge in terms of Libya, is the genocide of the black Libyans. So it's genocide, war crimes, and crimes against humanity. And then there's also the crime of aggression. That has been put on hold until 2017 because there supposedly is a dispute around what really constitutes the crime of aggression. Although in international law, that's been pretty clear for some time. And so what we laid out in our communication was that in the different instances, what represented war crimes, what represented crimes against humanity. We dealt with Libya. We dealt with the Ivory Coast in terms of really the French intervention, that there was a disputed election in the Ivory Coast, very similar to what happened with Bush v. Gore. And the highest body of the Ivory Coast had not decided, or really had decided that Gbagbo was the winner. But what there were lower bodies that had decided that Ouattara was the winner. And the French used the decisions of the lower bodies to say, we're going to go in, and Gbagbo was in the presidential palace. They bombed the palace. They went in, they arrested him. And the Security Council, once again, had put out a warrant for had put him before the ICC, and the ICC had issued a warrant for him for crimes against humanity in this struggle that occurred after the election, that there was armed struggle between both sides, but they didn't put out a warrant for anybody on the other side. And so it was very interesting, as one of our participants pointed out, Ouattara had an army to go in and take President Gbagbo out. And how did he get an army? I mean, it was a question like, it would be in Bush v. Gore if Bush said they went in and took Gore out, or Clinton out, by use of the army. On what basis did the army take sides? And so we dealt with that in there. We looked at the question of Haiti in terms of the de facto coup d'etat against President Aristide that was carried out by the U.S. and Canada, and kidnapping him and taking him where he didn't want to go. And then we also looked at the issue of what was happening in the United States in terms of just the many different attacks that people face. We focused on in particular the question of the whole prison industrial complex and the very disproportionate rate of incarceration of blacks and Latinos.
I was so heartened to see that you did that, Roger, and you actually referenced the tasks that Malcolm left for us, mm-hmm. to bring international spotlight on the crimes of the United States against people of African descent, and to see that your organization is carrying that out and going to The Hague to do it is precisely what Malcolm had in mind. Mm-hmm. Can you talk to us about that?
Yeah, certainly. The history of the December 12th movement in particular flowed from that, the whole issue of dealing with racism and white supremacy against black people in particular. We consider Malcolm our intellectual and political father in terms of that. And so those of us who are part of the December 12th movement come from a history of tying the question of our national to international issues, and understand that in this era of globalization, it is ever more important for our community to understand that the issues we face, the stop and frisk, the housing issues, the health care issues that we face in the street around the country are tied to what's going on internationally, because it's the same forces that are implementing that domestically and nationally that are doing it internationally. And it means that we have common allies, but we just don't always know who they are, because we're looking at things very narrowly. And so we thought that we see this campaign as being key in terms of implementing what Malcolm is talking about, of raising the issue that notwithstanding that there is a black man sitting in the White House, the conditions for black people are worsening. And our view and our position has been that for the last 10 to 20 years, the real agenda of the United States has been to take black people off that agenda, that we're not part of it, that they have no real use for us anymore. We've always been here as an economic necessity, and that given the nature of the of this economy of capitalism in its dying stages, they no longer need us for that, and therefore the only useful role we play in this economy is to work in the prisons. And under the 13th Amendment, as we all know, slavery is legal. And so our children in the schools are not being educated to function in a global economy in the 21st century. And what they're really being prepared for are to go into these penal institutions.
Roger, what happens if your petition is turned down? What would you do?
Well, if our petition is turned down, and we're pretty sure it's going to be turned down, the petition is part of a campaign. The petition was not an end-all and be-all in itself. What their denial to deal with our petition will do will be to further expose the ICC as a political institution, that it functions for the national and political interests of Western countries, to expose it as not being credible for people of African descent, for African countries, and for the rest of the world who are being subject to facing prosecution of it for political, very narrow political interests. And so we see that what we want to do is expose it as a fraudulent institution. We want people to understand that hopefully African countries will withdraw from that, and that, and this is not to say that crimes are not being committed, but Africans need to prosecute Africans for those crimes. They do not need the interests of the West to do that, because their interests have nothing to do with the real redress of human rights of African people. Their interests have everything to do with the exploitation of the African continent and African people. But that Africans can take care of Africans, and that black people throughout the diaspora have also to understand the need for a collective and a mutual unity for people of African descent and the African continent.
Attorney Roger Wareham, thank you very much for being on Law and Disorder.
Thank you very much for the opportunity.
If you want to hear Law and Disorder again, go to lawanddisorder.org on the web. You should also go to Law and Disorder Radio on Facebook.